I'm going to concentrate on one piece. And if there is any extra time, I'll move on to a second piece, but probably not. So I was going to talk about a piece which was called Google Office that I showed at Taipei Biennial in 2010. It was a large-scale architectural installation which resulted from a very specific invitation. So the Taipei Biennial 2010 was curated by Teerdad Solgaarde and Hong John Lin. And they wanted to make a biennial that was somehow very self-reflexive and address the conditions of its own making, address the institution, very much kind of coming from a kind of tradition of institutional critique. So they asked me to build an environment that would be a functional space, where all of the kind of seminars, screenings, that kind of stuff could happen. And also a lot of more social activities. So for example, one of the artists, Larry Shao, who was part of the biennial, was doing salsa classes as part of his project. So I was asked to kind of also incorporate a space which could be used as a dance space. So it was a kind of complex invitation with a lot of kind of very specific considerations to take into account in terms of how the space would be used, but also it somehow had to address the theme of the exhibition, which was, you know, looking at artistic labour, looking at the institution, addressing kind of working conditions within the art world somehow. So I wanted to open this out a bit and kind of make a bridge between working conditions in the art world and thinking around that, and then thinking about working conditions more generally in the, you know, kind of post-Fordist working conditions and working conditions in sort of a cognitive economy. What I ended up doing was building a space which was a parody of a Google office. What I was interested in was the kind of working environment that is characteristic of sort of, you know, media companies, advertising companies, technology companies, and generally sort of industry, and you know, the kind of companies that come under the broad umbrella of the creative industries, you know. And this is a kind of uncomfortable category, I think, which is kind of, you know, it's an economically driven term, I think, very much, you know, which, where there's a kind of convergence between art, design, and technology. Somehow all of these things come under this uncomfortable umbrella of being called the creative industries or sort of cultural industries, or in the UK, sometimes the creative economy. And within this kind of working environment, there's certain characteristics. So for example, you have a kind of collapsing of the categories of work and leisure, you know. The Google office, in a sense, it's a paradigm, you know. It's sort of a new kind of paradigm of an office space. It, you know, kind of, you'll see when I get onto images of the space itself, but it's sort of, you know, the kind of working environment that's meant to feel playful, where you're not meant to feel like you're at work, you're just hanging out with your buddies, kind of being creative and having fun. So the very first thing that I did was I made this contract, which is what we're looking at. And the contract is an intellectual property rights agreement, but it's written, it's a satire. I mean, the whole piece is a big kind of satire or sort of parody. And this agreement, use of the space was subject to this agreement. And the way that you give your consent is simply by reading the words, as you can see at the bottom. And this contract was sort of secreted about the space. Like it was all, you know, it was sort of in various parts of the space, on computer screens, on the wall, you know, so kind of people would sort of stumble across it at various points. And it basically states that that through use of the space, any kind of activity, you know, any sort of new knowledge generated through the use of the space, whether through work, play, or sleep, would become that could possibly be construed as being intellectual property, would become the intellectual property of Taipei Biennial. And what I wanted to kind of indicate with this is that for me, these kind of new style working environments within kind of you know, kind of cognitive capitalism and the creative industries, that they, despite on the surface, you know, having a very kind of friendly veneer, you know, you go to work wearing your own clothes, you call the boss by their first name, you can play ping pong, you know, in between working on your computer. It's a kind of new and subtle form of exploitation, you know. And so this contract was meant to indicate, you know, that there's still, it might look like fun, but, you know, there's still some kind of process of instrumentalization happening within these kind of environments. So this is the first kind of part of the space. So there was five different sections. And this is the entrepreneurial garden, which you can see a little bit more of. So it's kind of set up to look a bit like a kind of library space to some extent. A lot of computer terminals, you know, there's a, you know, you can lie around in the hammocks, you can hang out in the caravan, there's a little desk space within the caravan. And it's all modeled on the offices of Google. So that's, yeah, another view. Here's one of the artists from the show, relaxing, playing with his iPhone. And here's another space, it's called Genius Lounge. So all the spaces, I gave each space within the installation a title. So you had Entrepreneurial Garden, Genius Lounge, Innovation Hut. And I'm kind of interested in this kind of a vocabulary because the sort of vocabulary of, you know, using words like genius, it's kind of familiar from art history, you know. But within contemporary art, it's not acceptable today to use this kind of vocabulary anymore. There's been a very sort of solid critique of, you know, the romantic image of the genius artist, you know, because it's usually white male, you know, Western, et cetera, et cetera. But somehow this sort of vocabulary has slipped into the world of technology. So it's very common these days to refer to the CEO of a technology company as having a genius for business, or you know, having vision, being an innovator, you know, a business athlete. So, and a typical example of this would be someone like Steve Jobs, you know, at Apple, who, you know, who was widely referred to by these terms, you know, and then of course sort of would give kind of, you know, write books, business leaders now kind of write books about their vision and sort of, you know, how to lead and how to sort of bring your team with you, sort of following your vision. And this book, it's very, for me, it's kind of interesting that the vocabulary has, you know, kind of slipped out of our world and into this world of kind of technology. And it's part of this sort of conflation of, you know, art, design, and technology into this sort of, under this kind of umbrella of the creative economy. So here's the Innovation Hut. And here's a space, this was kind of a sort of hidden space at the back. So there was, behind the entrepreneurial garden, you would find this space through a door. And it was, it's called the R.J. Widler Levitation Suite. And the name of this space, I wanted to kind of allude to the kind of cultish aspect of, you know, of these kind of companies. Because with these figures, you know, this sort of, the kind of charismatic leader figures that you have within technology and media companies, like the Steve Jobs type figure, you know, there is really kind of a cultish aspect to this. And, you know, Google, like the culture within the Google company, you know, is absolutely that. And sort of, you know, when I was sort of researching the piece, I was stumbling, you know, I was reading all these kind of very odd blogs by Google employees, and there's all these kind of dreadful jokes about, you know, what happens in Google, and sort of jokes about how, you know, kind of they teach you levitation, you know. And really sort of like an enjoyment of and kind of, you know, sort of, what's the perpetuation of this kind of very cultish aspect of being a member of one of these companies, you know, as if you're part of a kind of club, you know, and you're sort of a follower of one of these kind of charismatic leaders. And part of this whole dynamic, it's worth pointing out, is a dynamic of exploitation. Because of course it's part of kind of why people kind of today within why kind of with post-Fordist, the conditions of kind of post-Fordist labor, why this within these particular industries people voluntarily work longer hours, kind of there's a sort of culture of self-motivation, working in teams, which on the surface seems very kind of pleasant, but it's sort of the inspiring leader is somehow meant to kind of compel people to to kind of be self-motivated, kind of help you reach this kind of self-fulfillment through work, somehow sort of, a midwife to your creativity if you're the employee. But of course, what you're exchanging is, there's a total kind of lack of security, lack of job security within this kind of industry. So this environment, it's modeled on this room. It's based on a Masonic lodge to some extent. And one of the reasons to put it there, aside from sort of alluding to this cultish aspect of Google, was I was interested in thinking about how the Freemasons are, their practices are a kind of theatricalization of the working conditions of the early modern period. So what they do in their ritual seems to be they act out, they kind of perform the apprenticeship system of the 17th century, more or less. So there's this idea of secrets, that as you ascend the hierarchy, you sort of receive more and more knowledge about, kind of masonry and all this sort of stuff. So it's a kind of acting out, kind of performance of work, which in some ways is what I was asking the audience to do within the space, because the space itself was very, very vigorously used. Like the audience of the Banyu kind of, used it as a sort of hangout space very much. But also because there was free Wi-Fi and a lot of computer terminals, as soon as it was open, people were there kind of checking their email, kind of like literally kind of working and sort of doing stuff. So they were performing for me or performing for the Banyu. And it was, it was a kind of theatricalized sort of performance of work in to some extent. And this, I wanted to kind of include this sort of, this backspace to sort of, in a way, as a kind of contrast or just some sort of allusion to earlier kind of ways of working or earlier sort of structures. Oh yeah, and this was quite a cute sort of image of some people using the space. So one of the other things I wanted to mention with regard to Google, one of the things that I got interested in while I was researching the piece, which wasn't necessarily kind of inherent in the piece, but it's something I'm sort of planning on looking at more in the future, was thinking about kind of Google and their kind of mission statement. So Google's mission statement is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. And I got very kind of interested in this and sort of interested in thinking about the difference between Google and a national library, say, because Google do have these projects, for example, the kind of book project, Google Books, which they started in 2004, to scan millions of volumes from university libraries, from about 25 university libraries across the US, and kind of digitize them and put them online. So Google kind of has aspirations to behave like a library, and to kind of some extent, one could even argue sort of replace the library system perhaps. And the other thing, of course, is that something like Google has a huge impact on what we think of, how we access knowledge. Because today it's one of the kind of primary ways in which any of us kind of get information about the world, Like the first thing most people do is Google something. If you want to find out about a person, a place, anything, of course, you Google it. And apparently, I even looked up statistics, and Google in Europe have, most of Europe, they have a kind of 90 to 95% share of the web search market. You know, Google really has a monopoly. Kind of what does this mean? It sort of means that a private company, you know, an American corporation, then has an enormous influence on what we think of as knowledge, which was interesting. And then if Google sort of, kind of begins to act more or less like a library with the Google Books project, you know, this is a private company replacing public institutions, or sort of, you know, libraries are generally sort of public services or considered to be public services, which is also interesting. And one of the things, I'm very interested in my work in thinking about formats. Like, I've spent a lot of time looking at different formats through which we kind of receive knowledge and different educational formats. And in the past, I did a very kind of long project, which ended up in a solo show in Stockholm called Information, Education, Entertainment, which looked at television. And I was thinking a lot about the difference between broadcasting, you know, kind of the television model, and internet, you know, which could be called, you know, termed narrowcasting perhaps, because the internet you engage with in relation to your existing set of interests usually, whereas the sort of broadcasting model is much more kind of, you know, the old-fashioned paternalistic model, like an institution like the BBC, you know, state-run, publicly funded, tells you what sort of culture is at home and abroad. It's a very different model. It's part of this kind of new world we're entering of sort of privatization and private companies replacing public services. How am I doing for time? Okay, so I might move on to talking about the other piece. Okay, so the second piece that I was going to talk about is this one. So, machine shall be the slave of man, but we shall not slave for the machine. And it was shown at the Tate in 2009. And it was an installation. And it's a very different area of research. But I think relates to the Google office to some extent, because one of the things with one of the things that I was interested in within the Google office is the sort of illusion of it being a free space, you know. So if you think about sort of contemporary working conditions, these kind of post-Fordist working conditions, they come about because of the demands of the 60s, in a way, kind of the May 68 generation, you know, demanding sort of more freedom, in a sense, you know, demanding sort of end to old-fashioned social hierarchies, demanding more time for, more time for leisure, kind of more authentic engagement with the world, more authentic social experiences, all this kind of stuff. But there's a kind of recuperation that happens within that process, so, you know, kind of, the demand happens at the end of the 60s, but by the 1990s and by the 2000s, you know, big companies have figured out, you know, how to sort of restructure themselves so that they appear to be free, while still there's some kind of, while still continuing to make an enormous profit, and actually offering less job security in return. But kind of these kind of demands, of course, are not, you know, were not only of the 1960s. So I was very interested in, for a long time, I was researching a movement from the 1920s, which was called the Kibbokift. And they were a British educational movement which emerged from the Boy Scouts just after the First World War. And it was a youth movement basically set up by a group of left-wing Boy Scouts in collaboration with the cooperative movement in the UK, and some people from the Campaign for Women's Suffrage. And what they wanted to do was to form a movement that would, where there was much more gender equality, you know. And they were kind of disillusioned with the sort of militarism of Baden-Powell's Boy Scouts. And they wanted something that was much more democratic, cooperatively structured, gender equality, and much more kind of creative, you know. So they went off to the forest and sort of started camping vigorously. And things kind of seemed to go pretty well for a while. But then one of the members of the movement, who was a guy called John Hargrave, basically took over and became charismatic leader. At that point, there was a schism. So the cooperators, the ones who'd come from the cooperative movement, left and set up the Woodcroft Folk, which still exists in the UK today and is still, you know, kind of very active as a left-wing youth movement. And they kind of set that up. And then the rest of the Kibbo-Kif kind of, you know, became a kind of new Kibbo-Kif with John Hargrave as charismatic leader. And then in the later kind of 20s and 1930s, it changed again. And Hargrave became very, very interested in an economic reform theory called social credit. You know, and it was sort of course, the time of the Depression, you know, economic crisis. And he sort of, so he got very involved with the social credit movement. And then they returned to the cities, kind of, you know, abandoned the countryside and sort of their kind of arts and crafts influenced activities of the 1920s and started kind of marching around the streets of London and sort of participated in the hunger marches that were happening at that time and started dressing in uniforms and calling themselves the green shirts. Like they started wearing these kind of paramilitary style uniforms with green shirts. And then by the Second World War, it came to an end. So I got very interested in this movement a while ago, and this installation was kind of the sort of end result, in a way, of all the research that I'd done. So what you see here is a reconstruction in the background of some of their costumes. So during their more kind of cultish phase, they became incredibly sort of ceremonial in their activities, and camping became a ritualized spiritual experience. And then the costumes got more and more elaborate. And then you also see a kind of small sort of research station on the right-hand side with a video piece which basically looks like a PowerPoint. You know, so really kind of using the format like PowerPoint, you know, like me now, kind of. You know, of course, it's the contemporary lecture format. And then on the left, there's a little diorama. So here's a close-up of the costumes. So the costumes are kind of a very odd combination of constructivism and sort of Robin Hood or something like that. Robin Hood's Merry Men. And here's a little kind of diorama that I made. You know, so the whole installation was sort of very much mimicking the museum. You know, it was meant to look like a kind of, you know, local social history museum or something. And the kind of research station was somehow sort of indicating that there's maybe some researcher engaged in, you know, kind of activity there. And then, you know, but with the diorama, so in the foreground you have, you know, the Kibbo-Kif having a nice time in the countryside, you know, being creative, making things, you know, and in the background the sort of nasty industrial city. And really kind of Hargrave and the Kibbo-Kif, you know, it was a critique of working conditions of the time, you know, and specifically their critique was directed, you know, at the sort of, you know, what they wanted was more leisure time. That was the main thing, and specifically sort of they wanted time for play, you know, for adults and children, and less social hierarchy, you know. So it's the same kind of, you know, the spirit of 68 or something, same kind of desires in a sense, you know, and at the beginning, you know, and they were specifically anti-capitalist. And this is a diagram of social credit and how it works. And so social credit theory, I have to say I'm not an economist, so I don't totally understand it, but the kind of, it seems to basically sort of, social credit theory includes within it an idea, it's critical of the banking system. And the idea is that, you know, you abolish the banking system and then you have kind of the national dividend, which is then distributed to all the citizens of the country. It's effectively to give everybody a citizen's wage. So in Hargrave's mind, Indra and Hargrave's mind, this was going to give people, the citizen's wage was going to give people time for leisure and play. And the idea of a citizen's wage pops up, you know, kind of from time to time. It's sort of an idea that seems to be mooted quite kind of regularly throughout the 20th and even 21st century. Like Richard Sennett, the sociologist, kind of wrote about it in one of his sort of books of the last 10 years. So it kind of pops up, you know, on the left and the right from time to time. But what kind of went wrong with social credit was, that it became anti-Semitic. So the social credit movement in the 30s got totally discredited because it was anti-Semitic at the fringes. And the kind of critique of banking kind of slid into this sort of murky territory of, conspiracy and sort of an international conspiracy of Jewish bankers and all that kind of stuff, you know. So really sort of social credit doesn't have a good reputation today at all. And these are some stills from the kind of PowerPoint or the video that was, you know, sort of pretending to be a PowerPoint. And it started with just a piece of graffiti that appeared outside my apartment in London in 2007. And I should say this is a piece that I made in 2007, right at the beginning of the financial crisis. And I was researching this work, hanging out in the archive at London School of Economics and reading all these newspapers from the 1930s. And there was that strange feeling that sort of these two historical moments were kind of collapsing into each other, because I'd be in the archives reading a newspaper headline that said Wall Street crash, you know, price of bread rises, riots in, you know, the third world. And then I'd go home on the bus and read basically exactly the same newspaper headline, you know, in 2007. So the video somehow kind of reflects on this, and sort of there's a lot about kind of archives and spending time in archives. And his this is sort of from the period when the kibbutzim started to become, when they're sort of having been sort of democratic and very cooperative and non-hierarchical at the beginning, this is sort of indicative of how they kind of began to go wrong. Like you see, you know, this sort of very bureaucratic kind of rituals emerging, you know, so these sort of, there's books and books and books of these kind of things and sort of directives from Hargrave where he's kind of demanding kind of his followers to wear particular clothing to the ritual, or sort of, you know, complaining that somebody turned up at a ritual wearing the wrong gemstone on their ceremonial belt, and, you know, and then sort of letters back saying, oh, I had the wrong gemstone because I couldn't afford to buy the ones that you said, you know. So the movement really kind of changed its character, but at the beginning I think there was this kind of emancipatory moment. Okay, so one more image. This is some of their activities in the earlier phase. So, they did yoga, they kind of paraded around a lot in costumes. And then this is sort of this is the later phase. So you sort of see, you know, this quite fascistic looking, it's a drawing of sort of this quite fascistic looking activities, you know, at the top. And one final point I should add is that one of the reasons why I made in the installation there were no archival images, there were no photographs. It was only ever drawings and descriptions. And you see photographs of the archive, but you don't see the actual photographs from the 1920s. And one of the reasons for that was to sort of cast doubt in the mind of the viewer on, you know, kind of the voice narrating the story, you know. So really to sort of think about, to kind of throw everything back on the format, kind of, you know, thinking about kind of the framework, like who's telling this story, what is the institution telling this story, what is this voice, you know, supposedly a voice of authority telling this story, but is it, you know, is it true or not? Which comes back to my interest in formats, in a sense, you know, as with my interest in Google, kind of thinking about, you know, what is the framework through which we receive information, or we are educated, or, you know, and that kind of thing. But I'll finish there because I think I'm out of time, aren't I?